This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For most of his life, Raymond Barfield was a person of faith, grew up in the Presbyterian Church, and maintained his belief right up to his early years as a physician. But as a pediatric oncologist working on experimental bone marrow transplants, his faith and emotional capacity were pushed beyond their limits. Ray burned out and, for a time, also abandoned his faith. He spent years reframing what it means to believe in God and to love in its truest form. And he emerged with a new philosophy about the intersection of science and religion. Today, Ray Barfield is an oncologist and pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke Health. He's also a writer and a professor of pediatrics and Christian philosophy at Duke University. Ray Barfield, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us what got you going on this idea that there should be, not only is there, but there should be some conscious interaction in the mind of particularly caregivers between the humanities, between the arts and science and also religion.
I think the thing that drove me towards that was coming up against the realities that my patients and families were experiencing and listening to the way that we described them on our rounds, which was mostly with the language of biology, sometimes with the language of finance, sometimes with the language of liability. But none of those languages were the languages that the families and patients were using. They were talking about what they were afraid of, what they hoped for. They were telling us what was at risk, what they might lose, what they had lost. And those things are the elements of stories, of storytelling.
But physicians hear that, don't they? I mean, they understand that you're fearful. There's this great loss that we're facing. And, I mean, don't you hear what they're saying and then just translate that and say, well, here are the odds and here are the chances that you won't have to suffer from that because we're going to offer you these care options? I mean, that's hearing them, isn't it?
You know, it is hearing their words and responding with a fix, which is what we do. We love to fix things. And patients come to us because we're good at fixing things. Most of the patients that I'll take care of in the next couple of weeks who come to me with cancer would really appreciate it if I would fix the problem of cancer, and I'm going to try to. So in that sense, you know, you hear their words and you respond with your fix. But there's another level of hearing that involves just being present to them, and they know the difference. I learned that they knew the difference because once I learned how to be more present to them rather than going straight to the fix, they would tell me things like, that's the first time that I've ever actually been listened to by a doctor. It's the first time I've felt heard by a doctor. And so the first time a patient told me that, I paid attention. I asked myself, well, what was different?
Let's go back to that. Can you recall that experience for us and tell us what was happening? Clearly, were you experimenting with this new mindfulness, this new kind of listening, or was it? Mm-hmm. Did you just stumble on it?
I was in the middle of confusion and chaos.
All right.
There was a kid who was 15 or 16 years old, and he had been transferred to my institution for transplant for a relapsed bone cancer that he had, Ewing sarcoma. And I came in the room. I could tell he was afraid. And he was very quiet. And so I sat down and I introduced myself. I said, my name's Ray, and you can call me Ray if you want to. We have a lot to talk about, but I'm interested in learning one thing about you that has nothing to do with your cancer. And so he pulled out a coin and started doing magic tricks for me. And it turned out that the guy was an astonishing magician. And he and I would use the language of magic and magic tricks as a way to open up difficult conversations. And we were able to go to some places I think he had never gone before in conversations. And ultimately, he ended up dying, but we were able to talk about his dying in part because we connected at a different level, just around magic. And I was just curious at the time, what are you interested in? But when he opened himself up and showed me the thing that he cared the most about, we connected as human beings. And that gave me a flavor of the kind of thing that I wanted to learn more about.
You also had an experience with parents, again, a young man who is approaching the age of 18, whose cancer had gotten fairly serious, and there was a kind of disconnect between the family and the patient on this, right?
I know who you're talking about. This was actually a kid with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, and he was in the late stages of it, and his heart was failing. The perception of the entire team, his cardiologist, and even the palliative care physician who had been asked to see him, was that he had no idea that he was dying. And so when I came on service, I went to his mom, and his mom said, that's right. He has no idea that he's dying, and we're going to keep it that way. So I asked her why. I said, tell me more about what your thinking is. And she said, Dr. Ray, he is the most joyful person I've ever known. And if he's moving towards the end of his life, I would rather him have the last part of his life lived with joy than with the terror that I know he'll have if we talk to him about dying. So it was a big disconnect between the way that we were all thinking about what we should do with a 17-year-old about to turn, 18 and become an adult, and what his mom was thinking.
So now, you're thinking, no, we really should tell him, right? But you think, as a team, he doesn't know. Mom thinks he doesn't know. You think he should. What happens next?
Well, one of the things that I've learned from parents, they've taught me to remember that when a child is dying, one of the things that means is that the only parenting that this parent's going to get to do is whatever happens in the last weeks and months of their child's life. They're not going to get to parent the child through marriage, through college, through grandkids, through all the crises that happen. This is it. This is their only parenting. And once that very simple insight hit me, I realized how presumptuous it was of me to take away this part of their parenting. And so even though I wanted him to know, that was kind of my baseline, she was telling me as his parent, I don't want him to know. So what happened is this. I told her, with her permission, I asked her, I said, you know, I want to respect that, and I will. I do have a worry. Would it be all right with you if I share what that worry is? And she said, okay. And I said, in my experience, sometimes children, when they know their parents are afraid and they know their parents are sad, they want to protect their parents. So they may know a lot more than they're letting on to because they know that you're scared. So what worries me is if a child does know they're dying and they're afraid, but they don't feel like they can talk to anyone, then they're alone. They're alone in their fear. That's the thing that worries me. So she heard that, and she loved this kid. So she started crying, and she said, well, then I don't know what to do because I want him to be joyful. But, of course, I don't want him to be alone in fear if he does know more than he's letting on. So what I offered to do, I said, you know, I'll go talk to him. And I promised her, I said, I will not take him down these roads you don't want him to go. I will respect your wishes, but I'll try to probe gently and see if maybe there's more there than we think. She gave me permission to do that. The people who had talked with him before had also asked him a lot of open-ended questions, mostly about himself. They'd asked, are you worried about anything? Do you have any questions? And he had always said no. He was always playing his video games, kept his eyes glued to the TV. Nope, no questions. No, I'm not worried about anything. I'm good. So I went in with the advantage of knowing what they had asked and decided to ask a different kind of question. I sat down with them and I said, I just had this wonderful conversation with your mom. She really loves you. And he's sitting there with his video game. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she loves me. And I asked him questions about her instead of himself. Do you think she ever worries over anything? Oh, yeah. She worries. Well, what does she worry about? Well, she worries about me dying. Well, do you ever think about that? Yeah, I think about it all the time. If your mom wanted to talk to you about this, would that be okay? And he said, yeah, I would like that. So with his permission, I went back and told her about the conversation. And she came in and they talked for a couple of hours. And within a day or two, we were able to send him home, which was his only wish, to go home. And he went home on hospice. He still had the drips to keep his heart going. And a couple of weeks later, they made the decision that they wanted to stop the drips. And so the hospice nurse called me, and I told her what to do. And he died a day later, very peacefully, at his home. But, yeah, that was...
Ray, I'm going to take a break right here. I'm talking to Ray Barfield. He's an oncologist and pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke, and we'll find out how he got to these conclusions when our program continues after this. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking to Raymond Barfield, a pediatric oncologist who studies theology and philosophy, currently an oncologist and pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke Health, a writer and a professor of pediatrics and Christian philosophy at Duke. So that's a lot. So, and after you told that story about radical listening and some fairly clever questioning that comes from wanting to know the real answers, I want to figure out how you got there. Take us way back. You're raised in Atlanta, Georgia, right? Mm-hmm. And your mother and father and sister were together. Your father's a pastor, a Presbyterian pastor, right?
That's right.
Tell us more about growing up.
Well, so my dad is a retired Presbyterian pastor. I suspect that he enjoyed being a pastor, but he was an unusual Presbyterian pastor. Probably, if I were going to use a word to describe him, it would be something closer to mystic. He spent his mornings in prayer and shaped his life. I don't mean to say it in the past tense. He's still alive. Shapes his life with what he takes to be a kind of patient responsiveness to what God says to his soul. That's what I grew up with. That's the kind of pastor that I grew up with. It was a very different sort of experience.
Were you religious and pious as a young man?
I had an experience when I was 7 that was life-changing for me. And it was an experience. It was at night. I was about to go to sleep. And I still don't know how to give you a full account of it. But I experienced the presence of God in the room, and it was not frightening, but it was undeniable. And from that point on, up until my adult life, really in medical school, I had a sense of the presence of God. It was a gift that I experienced. I guess I was religious. I mean, I went to church. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't particularly attached to any particular church or doctrine or creed or anything like that. So in that sense, I wasn't very religious. But certainly in terms of how I framed the world was full of light. It's full of meaning.
Though you may not have been religious in your mind in terms of the way you thought you were practicing, though I am told that after that mystical experience that you had, mm-hmm. you became a kind of evangelist.
Yeah.
You were a young man, right? You were
still I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was a kid. And, you know, I had a limited vocabulary and limited resources. And so I happened to have some tracts that talked about God, and I'd put them in my lunchbox. And during recess, I would try to tell people about this thing that I had experienced so that they could experience it too. I wasn't worried over their, you know, the eternal fate of their soul or anything like that. I just had this wonderful experience and wanted to share it with them. So
Well, what was the reaction to it? Because it's interesting. You've got this ineffable experience. The whole point of it is it will not fit in words. There's no way. Words
right.
are defined. This is an infinite experience. It is not the right kind of thing to be mm-hmm. telling people. But you're trying to. What was the reaction to your wanting to tell them or efforts to tell them?
Well, for the most part, I think it was sort of amused patience.
That's good.
You know, they would listen. I don't think I had a lot of converts.
No. Well, you convert to what? I mean, you still
exactly.
probably couldn't tell me what that was, right? I mean, that's the
right.
thing. And you finally, hopefully, you get to the point where you say, oh, wait a minute. You got to have your own experience, and then we'll have coffee. Talk about your mom, too, because she was talented. She sang, right?
Well, my mom, who is a mom, I mean, she is, you know, cooks meals and took us to back and forth to school and was very mom-like. But she is a fantastic piano player and organ player. And my dad is the singer. He's an operatic tenor. When he was a young man, he heard a tenor named Mario Lanza, and it just hooked him. And at that point, he knew that he wanted to spend his life learning how to sing like that. So the two of them, we had a small house, and there was a little room in there where the piano was. And I grew up with my mom playing the piano and my dad singing Vesta La Juba. But they did it just in the room. It wasn't it wasn't so much in public.
Come from a long line of storytellers. At least one of your grandfathers was a pretty good storyteller, right?
That's right.
Your maternal grandfather?
My grandfather on my mom's side was probably the best storyteller that I've ever come across. He knew how to take a story and ground it in physical reality, but still have the story feel funny, sometimes strange. And his stories always had a beginning, a middle, and an end. They didn't just wander. They got something across. And so I would listen to him, and he would rub his thumb against his little finger the whole time he was telling it. I don't know why, but it was just this little tick that he had, and tell his story. And sometimes the stories were hilarious. He was eloquent. And that's the thing that grabbed me, because he also, both my grandfathers only had an eighth grade education. My parents were the first to graduate from college. And I think my mom's dad, my grandfather, really struggled with a sense of inadequacy around not having formal education, even though he was as articulate as anyone that I've ever come across, and had a genuine earth-grown kind of eloquence to him.
And on your father's side, your grandfather on that side was having some trouble. He had some troubles with alcohol. Was that it?
He did. He struggled with alcoholism, and he also was an interesting guy. Eighth grade education, but when he was a young man, when he was 15, he knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to work with cars. And Henry Ford had this plant. And so he decided he was going to leave and go up to Michigan to Henry Ford's plant. My grandfather ended up being Henry Ford's chauffeur. And he would drive Henry Ford around. Sometimes Thomas Edison, who was elderly at the time, would visit Ford. And so my grandfather would tell stories about, you know, Ford and Edison being in the back of the car while he drove him around. But his alcoholism interrupted that. Mm-hmm. And he ended up coming back to Georgia and made his money as a mechanic. He was a terrific mechanic, but he would hit a binge, and then he was a different person.
I wonder what's going through your mind at this point, particularly after your experience, that sense of oneness, that sense, as you say, that of experiencing God. Did you begin to start to think of what it was you were going to do? Did you have a sense of commission and purpose at that point or not?
It took me a long time to figure out what I wanted to do. The earliest thing that has stayed with me was writing. I knew I wanted to be a writer. Even as a kid, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And I wasn't very good at it. But I loved the things that I read, and I knew who I wanted to write like. And that sort of grew over time. I didn't decide to go to medical school until after college. So while I was in college, I thought I was going to be a philosopher and a writer.
I wondered if you, in those earlier years, had any sense. You know, you've mentioned your father had this great operatic voice. Mm-hmm. He was a Presbyterian minister, but deep down inside, he was less, you know, tethered to the doctrine than to something deeper. All giving suggestions, and again, grandfathers who may have had bigger aspirations had they had the education, which could lead you to think that people, we get trapped. Like, I don't want to be trapped like any of them who seem to be one. Maybe they didn't. Maybe your father seemed perfectly happy. But there's a way in which you can see that as a young man as being trapped, and that's not going to happen to me. I wonder if those thoughts were going through your mind.
Well, I was pretty sure that I didn't want to go into the church. you know, it was. I've seen a lot of things that have shown me that the institution of the church is just as susceptible to the kind of battles over power, over prestige, over trying to appear one thing when you're actually another thing. So I saw a lot of harm, and I never attached myself to some idea of success looking like, you know, a certain set of accomplishments, that was what was necessary in order to, you go from point A to B to C. It was always an orientation towards just trying to flourish, to live well. Happiness mattered to me.
And I'm looking, too, at some of the various influences on you that shaped the man you have become and are in the process of becoming. I know that you had a powerful experience when someone close to you, a classmate, died, and that was your earliest experience of death. Talk about that and the influence it's had on you.
Well, this was a 16-year-old kid when I was in high school. His name was Richard, and he died of leukemia. With Richard, there were several things, I think, that affected me and my imagination in ways that didn't come out fully until much later, even when I was in medical school and trying to decide what kind of physician I wanted to be. You know, one was that he was young and dying. Why? Like, why? Why would a 16-year-old get cancer? The second thing was the fact that it was cancer. There's something creepy about your own cells beginning to multiply and take you over. You're not being invaded by some outside force like an infection. Your own body has decided it's going to break the rules and it's going to kill you. And that by itself is frightening. So that was scary. But the thing with Richard is the hiddenness. We knew that he had leukemia. He just sort of disappeared for a long time. And then he came back to class for a while, and he was there for a couple of months. And then he disappeared again. And then he died. And most of his experience was a black box for the rest of us. We didn't know what he had gone through. All we knew is that he had died. And that left open a lot of questions and uncertainty.
Was there any discussion about this with the class or bringing in, you know, sort of people to talk about what was going on? Or it was just one day he's not there and there's an announcement and move on?
It was more of a moving on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this came after an earlier experience that you had with death. Both of your grandparents died.
That's right. This is my earliest memory. My grandparents on my dad's side both died on the same day, one in the morning and one at night. And after my grandfather had died in the morning, they didn't tell my grandmother. She was sick. So they didn't tell her. But she died that night. And what I remember about it, I was 4, which is younger than the age where you really begin to develop a concept of death. What I did have a concept of was my dad crying. I could respond to that. And so my earliest memory is my dad holding me in the funeral home. And both my grandparents are in their coffins. And one's up against one wall, one's up against another wall, so their heads are close together. And I'm just looking down into the two of them, and I see them dead, with no concept of dead. But everyone else was crying, so I cried. That was... in retrospect, it's fascinating to me that's the earliest thing that I remember. But it's also interesting to me that as a child, they were simply dead, but I had no other concept or frame to do anything with that thought. I just responded to my parents. They were the ones who gauged my response. I did what they did.
How has that or has it informed you or shaped your ideas around palliative care, around your profession and oncology, as you look back and now are able to reframe those thoughts?
Well, even in my own life, I've had changes in the ways that I respond to dying. And so I'm not the same person at these different points in my life. One thing it's done is to give me some humility when I'm talking with someone who's coping with death or facing the potential death of someone that they love or of themselves, to not assume that I know what they're thinking or feeling, but to let them tell me. If I've been several different people over the course of my life, there's no way that I can get access to what they're thinking or feeling. The other thing is to have no judgment towards whatever it is that they're feeling or thinking. And people are concerned sometimes, especially if they're feeling something that they think might be not approved of. Mm-hmm. They're concerned about being judged. If they become convinced that you're not judging them, that you're just interested in who they are and what they're experiencing, you just want to be with them, they can have a great deal of relief by telling you, you know, I'm not sure I'm supposed to say this, but he has suffered for a long time, and I'm going to be really sad. But I got to tell you, there's a little bit of relief, too. And I don't know if I should be feeling that.
And in that moment, at least, at the very least, as you talked about earlier with the young man who's you brought together with his mother, and, you know, they reconciled and understood that both knew what was going to happen, at least you're not alone, right?
That's right. Yeah. At least you're not alone. Yeah.
When did you decide to be a doctor, and what drove that decision?
Well, so when I graduated from college, I was about 2 weeks from going to Columbia University to do graduate work in philosophy. And my girlfriend had broken up with me. And so I decided, instead of having a really original response, I would do something more in the category of cliche. And I bought a ticket to Europe and went to Europe and just started wandering around Europe and Israel, moaning about my loss. And deferred Columbia for a year. They said I could come the next year. And while I was there, a friend of mine who I had met in the United States but who lived in Germany, she worked it out with her dad for me to stay in his basement in Tübingen, Germany, whenever I was between my trips to Italy or to Greece or to Israel or wherever. Turns out he was a surgeon. He was a gynecologic surgeon and one of the leading surgeons in Germany, Dr. Hirsch. So when I would go and stay with him for a couple of weeks, every day he would take me to the operating room And as I followed him around and watched what he did, I decided that's what I wanted to do. I thought, why would I want to do anything else besides be a surgeon?
What was it about that that led you to that conclusion?
I think it was the beauty of the craft. It wasn't a sort of noble aspiration to change the world or do anything like that. I thought what he was doing was beautiful. And so I became interested in the craft. I started working on my knots and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'd rather you kind of work on the knife and let the knots come later. I mean, I'm just thinking that's the part I'm worried about, but I understand what you're saying. Very cool. And then you went to Emory, right?
That's right. So I graduated from Emory Medical School and stayed there for residency and stayed there for graduate work. My wife went to seminary at Emory, so we did a lot of stuff at Emory in Atlanta.
Ray Barfield, an oncologist and pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke Health, a writer, a professor of pediatrics and Christian philosophy at Duke. And we will hear much, much more when our program continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, spending the hour with Raymond Barfield, whose work takes him to the intersection of spirituality, philosophy, and medicine. Ray is an oncologist and pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke Health. He's a writer and a professor of pediatrics and Christian philosophy at Duke. So we got you to Emory. You're going to med school. You were very interested in surgery at the time, practicing your knots. But then you ended up on a pediatric oncology floor, which you described as being a spiritual place. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. You know, I had a deep interest in philosophy, and a good part of my life had been spent living with this presence that we talked about, with this kind of light that I didn't have a good account for, but that I accepted anyway. When I walked onto the oncology floor in my junior year, the pediatric oncology floor, I definitely felt something. I didn't know how to put it into words. Spiritual is probably a good word for it. There was something about the combination of the sort of mythologizing of cancer that we have, at least in America, and the fact that this was happening with children, that loosened all of our assumptions, all of the things that we take as a given. You know, the average lifespan is 86.3 years. I can expect to live that many years with this many cars and this, you know. All of it is undermined when a child gets cancer. And with cancer, you know, the therapy is long, especially with the most common cancer, which is acute lymphoblastic leukemia. That goes on for 2.5 to 3 years, depending on your gender. So the staff knew the kids. And, yeah, there was something on that floor, the combination of kind of questions that were asked, the kind of care that was given, the kind of disruption, the flavor of disruption that childhood cancer brought into lives, and the ways that people responded to this disruption, that just captivated me. And I began thinking, maybe I'm going to do something besides surgery.
What about, I mean, that sounds like the hard part. That sounds like the part that would drive you out the door, the suffering, the difficulty, the difficult conversations. And as you say, just the duration of this and watching it all unfold. And you were attracted to that.
I was drawn to it. I was drawn to it deeply. And my entire, the remainder of medical school and residency and my fellowship, I continued to be drawn to it. I did hit a point later in my career where I thought, uh-oh, I thought I was made for this, but I am not sure I can do this the rest of my life.
What was happening?
Well, I was a bone marrow transplant attending at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which is a children's cancer hospital in Memphis.
Bone marrow transplant?
Bone marrow, yeah. stem cell transplant. There's a lot. And we were doing an experimental approach to stem cell transplant for kids who had high-risk cancers but did not have a donor. We were using their parents, which means that the bone marrow, the graft, was not matched to the children. It was only half matched. Mm-hmm. Put the kids at a lot of risk to die from something called graft-versus-host disease. So my early research projects were in manipulating these grafts so that we could use them for these kids. we had a 50% mortality rate. And the way we justified it to ourselves is that without the transplant, it would be 100% mortality rate. So at least we're doing better than 100% mortality rate. But the density of death and suffering that I experienced during that phase of my career really tested my, it tested everything about me, not just my medical skills. That part was easy, but my spiritual life and my emotional life and the kinds of resources I had to cope with these things. And what it did was to show me that my resources were pretty thin.
But what was your reaction? Did you end up deciding to leave and in terms of spirituality? Mm-hmm. I mean, did it engender an anger or a curiosity about how you could rebuild and kind of strengthen these skills? Which way did you go after that?
I was very sad, and I was afraid because I had gone through 4 years of college and 4 years of med school and 3 years of residency and 4 years of fellowship to get to this point. And now I'm thinking about a career change. That was scary and disorienting, as was the idea of coming home and telling my wife after all that I'm going to switch careers. But I was the biggest crisis for me. There were two. One was that my training, my formation as a physician had not given me the skills that I needed to walk into a room where I was no longer able to offer a cure and yet to continue to be meaningfully present as a physician to the patient and to the family. As soon as I lost the language of cure, as soon as I could no longer be the hero that walked into the room and said, "We've got this, I have something that might be able to cure you," as soon as I lost that, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know where to take them. I didn't know how to help them with decisions. All I knew how to do was the next technical response to the next biological change. And that was very difficult for me because with such a high mortality rate, it meant that I was incompetent to continue to care for a very large number of my patients. The other thing, though, at the same time, was the image that I had in my mind of God, of who God was, began to stand out in pretty sharp contrast to the reality of the suffering that I was witnessing. And I came to a place where I could not see how both things could be true, the way I thought about God and the suffering I was witnessing. But the suffering was there. It was in the room and undeniable. One of them had to go, so it was God. And that's where I had the what I thought was atheism. I thought, I don't believe in this anymore. And I didn't want to stop believing. I just couldn't believe. So that was a terribly disorienting time of life. My sense that I had not been given the skills to care for these patients who were dying when I couldn't talk about cure. And at the same time, having the frame, my whole frame for how I looked at the world shift so radically.
You said the training you did get in terms of having difficult conversations, I thought is instructive. Maybe you can tell us what it was you were told about difficult conversations in med school.
My training. And so I was given, two training sessions. One of my training sessions, which lasted about 8 seconds, was this. Ray, when you're delivering bad news, here's the key. Never let the family get between you and the door. That was piece of advice number one. The second piece of advice that I got, and I literally got no other advice between these two pieces of advice. The second piece I got in fellowship, and I had a patient with this terrible brain tumor that had spread all over the surface of his brain. It was clear that he was dying. But we had just done an MRI, hoping that our experimental therapy had maybe caused it to regress a little bit, and we could give some small good news. Hey, good news, it's a little bit smaller. No, it was terrible. The radiologist's read of it had nothing to do with describing the tumor. The only thing that the radiologist said was, bad day to be him. And so my attending physician, on the way up to the room to talk with the family, said, well, do you want to tell them or do you want me to? And I said, I guess I need to learn how to do this. And he said, well, here's the only advice I have for you. When you say it, make sure you've said it. That's pretty good advice in a way. Mm-hmm. Make sure you've actually told them the truth and not avoided it. Mm. So it's pretty good advice. But it didn't help me learn the how of that. I had to learn that on my own.
So talk a little bit more about that and about how you resolved, reconciled, or moved forward with your disbelief now in a deity, in God. Mm. What'd you do with that?
Well, it stayed for a while. Mm. It stayed for the better part of a year, over a year. And I came to a place where I had a different problem than this problem of suffering, this problem of evil. I also came up against the problem of good. I came up against my sense that when I loved my daughter or my son, that there was more to that love than just biochemical reactions in my brain that were evolutionarily selected. It felt like it meant something. You know, when I would read about moral atrocities around the world, I felt like they were really wrong. Not just that I was having a sort of biologically determined response that could be summarized as, you know, yuck, or, you know, I don't like that.
Bad day to be them.
Bad day to be them. Mm. It felt wrong. Mm. But I didn't know where to put the wrong. I didn't know what to do with this ought, this sense that things ought to be different. So it left me with a problem. I mean, I had a problem of suffering that had led me away from this God that I believed in. And I had this problem of good where I wasn't satisfied with a universe that's just atoms in the void. I needed a better explanation for meaning and for longing and for joy and for love and for morality and for everything else. So that's what put me back on my journey towards just asking the questions. And I came across a Catholic, Thomas Aquinas, who sort of is the central theologian of the Catholic Church.
The Summa Theologian.
The Summa Theologian.
Were, yes.
And in his Summa Theologica, I came across this one little sentence that changed the way that I framed the search for God. And Thomas Aquinas, the church father of the Catholic Church, said the deepest thing that we can know in this life about God is that we don't know what God is. And I thought, if Thomas Aquinas can say that, then surely it's okay if I don't have a comprehensive explanation for who or what God is. And that opened me up to a different kind of search, to the possibility of a mysterious God who was truly beyond my comprehension, but who nonetheless was the highest thing that I could seek after.
It seems to me that that could leave you open also to the possibility that you could be competent, skilled in a profession, know what you're doing, and still be open to the mystery that this thing isn't going to end the way I had engineered it.
Yes.
And that this person on the other end of this conversation might say something that could be terribly difficult for me, and I leave myself open to that instead of protect myself.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. The letting go of a lot, letting go of control, letting go of the certainty of my answers to the question, what kind of universe do I live in? Letting go of my image of God, which at that point in my life had become more of an idol than something that was pulling me towards truth. Letting go of the illusion that I myself am not going to die. You know, coming to terms with my own mortality. It was serial forms of letting go. And among the things that I had to let go were the things that were interrupting my practice of medicine when my patient was no longer curable. I had to let go of my ego that said, this is my personal failure, which is the most arrogant thing that a physician can say, because the corollary to that is that every time a life is saved, it's my personal save.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about that in that moment, because we do use that, the language of fight, you know. They fought, and we're going to beat this thing, and the families will use that language. Mm-hmm. Doctors may use that language, and it does. I mean, you can understand how you want to hold on to that. Certainly as the family, we're going to fight, we're going to beat this. I can understand that language. On the other hand, it really does personalize it, and it becomes a victory or a loss, right? Mm-hmm. And my fault. If we don't beat it, then maybe it didn't try hard enough. What do you do with that language when you hear it? Because you understand the need for it. On the other hand, it could be destructive at some level, I think.
That's right. And if a family needs the language, they can use the language. The families can use the metaphors that they want to use. But it stopped working for me. It stopped working for me. And it's not that it didn't feel like I was up against a kind of enemy. It's not that. It's not that I don't understand the metaphors, but there comes a place where one of the things that Hippocrates taught his students, he said, one of the greatest gifts that a physician can give to a person is to let them know when they're overcome by their disease. And what he meant by that is when they've come to a place where no therapy will help them, and they now have to face the reality that their life is coming to an end. One great gift that you can give them is to recognize that because of your experience and to have the courage to tell them so that they can close out their life in a way that's meaningful to them and that fits the remainder of their story, the rest of how they've lived their life. I think that's fantastic, you know. And so at that point where someone's overcome by their illness, one of the best things that you can do is to just be present, tend them more like a garden than like a fight.
And I guess be willing to endure maybe some difficult moments for yourself when that grief pours out and you don't really have an answer.
To be sure.
Dr. Raymond Barfield, an oncologist, pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke Health. He's a writer. He's a professor of pediatrics and Christian philosophy at Duke University. What a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
You can find out more about his work and his books at our website, stateofthings.org. We're also taking submissions for the next Movies on the Radio, and we're talking about money, movies and money. So give us your favorites. SOT at WNC.org if you want to be part of that program as well. A program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brooklyn, Robert Kinlaw, and Angelique Perrin. Amanda Mangus is with us as well, or is it Magnus? I don't know. She hasn't started yet, but she'll be here in a minute. She's going to be here in a minute, and we'll have Amanda on the show as well. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.